the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hearing, hearing, hearing. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument is Wilhelm versus the County of Milwaukee. Mr. Lynch.
Good morning. The question on appeal here is whether Randolph Wilhelm's Civil Rights Act damage claims should go forward, whether they should have their day in court. Wilhelm's claims that he was denied due process of law have merit. The process he went through was inadequate and failed to meet the standards of due process established in United States Supreme Court precedent.
Could you clarify exactly what it is that you think he did not get at the end of the day from the various Wisconsin procedures he went through? Because he is presently reinstated, is that not correct?
Yes, he is.
And he received, ultimately, a full back pay award.
Correct.
So what's left over?
He didn't receive any form of pre-termination due process. He
but
was
why
not
do
given.
We care? I mean, what the remedy for that's usually to give somebody a hearing, right?
Well, the remedies afforded under the Federal Civil Rights Act go well beyond the granting of a hearing. They go to the monetary damages sustained by the plaintiff as a result of the failure to follow the procedures.
But what are those damages other than the back pay that he got?
They are damages associated with his mental distress, his anguish, the suffering that he went through as a consequence of the very long delay between when he was terminated and the hearing he obtained several years later after he first was denied a hearing by the Personnel Review Board because it had a policy of not granting hearings to him or to any other similarly situated persons. Then bringing a court action to have that reviewed, prevailing in that, then defending against an appeal, and then ultimately getting a hearing years later. And the Supreme Court has clearly recognized that that form of the lack of pre-termination hearing rights and the inadequacies of the post-termination hearing rights are a violation of the Federal Civil Rights Act. And my client had no opportunity to present his Federal Civil Rights Act claims in the state court proceedings in the administrative body or on certiorari review.
But your opponent points out that he then filed a second state court action where he did have an opportunity to present everything. Why is it that now he gets a third bite at the apple?
The second action that was filed by my predecessor counsel for Wilhelm is a very different case. It's not a Civil Rights Damage Act case. It doesn't have the same core of operative fact that the Federal Civil Rights Damage Act case is. It was a case to determine whether the county as a debtor to Wilhelm had an obligation to pay interest on the back pay award.
Well,
there was no.
This is really all about attorney's fees, isn't it?
Attorney's fees is one of the elements of damage that would be claimed in a Federal Civil Rights Act case that were not afforded under the administrative procedures that my client followed.
Well, it's 99% of this case, isn't it?
Well, the emotional distress damages are also significant. The interest on back pay issues that would arise as a Federal Civil Rights Act claim basis. But attorney's fees is a significant aspect. And, of course, one of the more important aspects of the Federal Civil Rights Act is to be able to recover attorney's fees when your rights are violated.
Well, didn't you seek attorney's fees in that second action that Judge Wood is talking about, where you sought interest, you also sought attorney's fees?
The record is very incomplete about what was sought or what, if anything, was determined in the interest on back pay case. Nothing in the record that I reviewed indicates that there was any attempt to obtain attorney's fees in the interest on back pay case that was presented.
But the question isn't whether it was actually tried. The question is whether the Wisconsin courts would have been open to that had it been tried. And you did say that the interest was an element of the second case, so I certainly don't see how that could be an element of this case, unless there's a rule in Wisconsin that you can just keep filing cases over and over and over again.
It's important to recall that to note that the law on this matter in Wisconsin is very different from other states. Wisconsin is a state that does not require joinder of claims, either claims or counterclaims. As Justice Babich stressed in the Hanlon case, which was sent to Wisconsin court for by this court for review, he pointed out that the failure to join a federal civil rights act claim with a certiorari action reviewing the termination, reviewing the administrative action, was not required.
But Wisconsin,
and Wisconsin
does
would not preclude the second action because of failure to join the civil rights act claim with the
other claim. That's phase one. We're talking about phase two, the second action, and Wisconsin, as I recall, does take a transactional approach to claim preclusion. Things that arise out of the same transaction are considered part of the claim, and so whether or not it has permissive, mandatory joinder rules isn't really the point. The point is, are you splitting claims?
The central issue with respect to the second action is whether or not the second action was the same claim as the Federal Civil Rights Act claim, whether it had the same core of operative facts, whether any of the operative facts in the interest action were material to a Federal Civil Rights Act claim. If they're separate and distinct claims, because there's no requirement to join them, Wisconsin would not preclude the separate claim from being instituted. This interest on back pay claim arose years after the facts had to do with the termination of my client, and the interest on back pay case didn't depend at all on the facts that supported the order of back pay. So there was, the interest on back pay case was not my client's day in court with respect to his federal civil rights claim.
Mr. Lynch, assuming a court, or this court obviously, would get to the merits of the case, what's wrong with the waiver in this case?
Well, first,
is there any indication it wasn't knowing? Anything in the record to suggest that?
The scope of the waiver was the fact that my client waived a challenge to the December 1995 urine analysis. He clearly waived that right. Whether the interpretation placed on that waiver by, in these earlier proceedings, by the county, to have the scope of that waiver waive all rights respecting employment disputes that would arise after the waiver was instituted in, which, under general, even a general release wouldn't do that, was a stretch of that waiver. It wasn't what anything my client knew or understood would be a consequence of waiving it.
Excuse me. Is it a stretch with regard to whether or not there's a waiver of that pre-termination hearing when there's a second incident?
I'm sorry.
You say it's too broad an interpretation. As I understand it, he waived, or anyone similarly situated, with the second, if there's a urine analysis positive, waived that pre-termination hearing. Is that what you're challenging is too broad, that there could be such a policy?
Well, there's a second response to this. First is, on this record, the county hasn't disputed and doesn't dispute in the federal civil rights action that my client was entitled to a hearing under the facts and circumstances presented. They have acknowledged that the court still ruled in Wisconsin, and they are not, on this record, the issue that you brought up is not presented because the other side is not contesting it, and the issue has already been, you already have the benefit of the interpretation of the waiver that the state court put on it in terms of what it did and didn't waive and whether there was notice or not and what its adequacy was. It seems to me what is, basically my position is that that's not before the court for decision if the case goes forward.
Do you want to save a little time for rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lynch. Mr. Jorgensen.
Good morning. My name is John Jorgensen. I'm a principal assistant corporation counsel from Milwaukee County. and I'm appearing for all of the named plaintiffs, or defendants, rather. My goodness. You've stolen some of my thunder with your questions, and I've anticipated to a great extent.
That's why they pay us these significant salaries.
Yes. Frankly, I would be delighted if the court would look to a case which was cited by the plaintiff and on which he has placed considerable reliance, a state of Wisconsin case, Parks versus the City of Madison at 171 West 2nd, 734-92 Northwest 2nd, 365, for a cogent summary of the applicable principles of claim preclusion which I think govern this case and which the court has already zeroed in on some of its earlier questioning. The general principles of res judicata or claim preclusion are well known and well accepted. The rule reflects two important policies, encouraging the finality of judgments and preventing repetitive litigation.
Mr. Jorgensen, your opponent argues that the second action in the Wisconsin courts was essentially just about a debt. I mean, it could have been for goods sold and received, it could have been for anything, and thus isn't part of the same transaction.
I think that gives too little credit to the complaint in that action, which is in the record as an appendix to my proposed finding of fact that was filed in the district court in support of my motion for a summary judgment. The complaint in that action specifically alleges that the plaintiff was terminated without a hearing and then recites the facts leading up to his eventual award of back pay. By way of its damage claim, it recites, as a result of defendant's termination by plaintiff, plaintiff has suffered monetary damages, in this case for the loss of the use of his wages, from the date they would have been earned until the plaintiff was paid back on May 11th, 2000. So it's not simply an action in aid of collecting on the award that the PRB entered. The plaintiff was acting for interest on his wages from day one, from the date of his discharge, and also adds an additional claim for theft under Wisconsin law, apparently on the grounds that the plaintiff was so obviously entitled to a hearing that the fact that the county fired him and did not pay him until ordered to do so by the PRB amounted to theft. And there is also in the addendum...
I get to ask a question once in a while.
I'm sorry, I was getting to that.
Okay. What does it say about attorneys?
In the addendum clause, the request is for a judgment against the defendant for interest in the amount of 12% from June 21st, 96, the very date of his separation, not the date of the PRB award, forward on plaintiff's wages from the date should have been from... No, that's not my mistake. Plaintiff's previous counsel's mistake. On plaintiff's wages from the date same should have been paid for treble damages, for reasonable attorney fees and all costs of this litigation, for such other relief as the court may deem appropriate. So I would say at that stage of the game, the plaintiff was asking for attorney fees, was asking for not merely remedies and aid of the PRB award, but for damages specifically attributable to the fact that he did not receive, as he claims he was entitled to, a hearing on his claim that he couldn't urinate back when the county first discharged him in 1996. So I would say at that stage of the game, the operant facts were precisely identical to those that the plaintiff now posits in this, yet his third action on this same factual situation. Now we're past any consideration of Hanlon or Stotts or anything like that. The operant facts now, when plaintiff files his third action, are that it was very hard for me to get my hearing. I finally got my hearing. I got my back wages completely, all my back pay, all my back benefits. I've been restored, but I yet am entitled to still more damages. In the second action, he specifically asked for interest, treble damages on a theft claim, and attorney fees. Now he's developing yet another theory. I should get some additional Section 1983 damages based on that very same state of affairs. And I think it's clear under preclusion law, which is virtually identical in this circuit to preclusion law in the state of Wisconsin, that that claim is barred. The rule bars relitigation of the same cause of action between the same parties where the first litigation resulted in a valid final judgment. I don't think there's any question that the second state law action resulted in a valid final judgment. The signed stamped judgment is in the record, again as an exhibit to my defendant's proposed findings of fact. The judgment signed by a circuit court judge reciting that the action is dismissed on its merits. And it's a little late in the day now to attack the validity of that. So there is a valid final judgment. In order for the first action to bar the second, there must be an identity of parties and an identity of the causes of action or claims in the two cases. As far as identity of the parties, that's well rehearsed, I think, in my brief. All of the named defendants are sued in their official capacities as employees or agents in Milwaukee County, so for purposes of preclusion law under Wisconsin law or Seventh Circuit law or probably any law at all, they are Milwaukee County for purposes of the doctrine of claim preclusion. As far as there being identity of claims, the court has already gone into that. Wisconsin has adopted the transactional analysis informed by the restatement second of judgments. All claims arising out of one transaction or factual situation are treated as being part of a single cause of action, and they are required to be litigated together, says the Wisconsin court. Application of the rule of res judicata, or in the more contemporary usage, a claim preclusion, does not depend upon actual litigation of an issue. The earlier judgment is conclusive as to all matters which were litigated or which might have been litigated. Thus, if the present claim arose out of the same transaction as that involved in the former action, it is barred, even though the plaintiff is prepared in the second action to present evidence or grounds or theories of the case not presented in the first action, or to seek remedies or forms of relief not demanded in the first action. I can't imagine a clearer description of what the plaintiff is attempting to do in this case. For whatever reason, when he went back to state court, after he had already gotten due process, by the way, as the court has already discussed, he, for whatever reason, elected to proceed on the theory that he was entitled to interest from the date of his discharge, treble damages, and attorney fees, but did not specifically plead Section 1983 or ask for the hedonic 1983 damages of the sort that plaintiff's counsel has referred to. But that's, at this stage of the game, under the doctrine of claim preclusion, frankly, a horse on the plaintiff. He ought to have brought those claims, if not when he first took cert from the decision of the PRB, certainly when he came back and sued the county yet again, seeking more money after he'd already gotten due process, after he'd gotten his job back, after he'd gotten full back pay and benefits, and restored to the position in county service where he remains to this very day.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Lynch?
With respect to the matter of the operative facts in the interest on back pay case, the background of how a debt arose, even if it's recited in the pleadings, if it's not facts that are at the core of what that action is about, that's interesting background, but those are not the operative facts for purposes of claim preclusion.
But he was asking for damage, independent damages and attorney's fees. Surely it's a matter for the court to construe that complaint and see what the scope of it was, and if the scope of it arose out of the same transaction as what he's now trying to present, this was resolved in the county's favor.
Well, it's my position as the burden is on the county to prove the preclusive effect of that judgment if they are going to prevail on a summary judgment motion. But in any event, the request for attorney's fees was not a request for attorney's fees that were incurred as a result of his termination, but only to request attorney's fees that might result from pursuing the interest action. So it is not the claim for attorney's fees that the Civil Rights Act matter would cover, and is a different scope.
I believe Judge Wood had a question.
And if a Wisconsin action is dismissed for want of jurisdiction, it's not a final judgment on the merits for claim preclusion points of view, and I think I've addressed that aspect of the second action in my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Thanks, both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.